Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Pantaloons podcast with me, Steve Purcell.
And me, Mark Haywood.
And this is still an unnamed podcast. We've had some brilliant suggestions in our social media comments. One listener suggested we call this podcast Talking Pants.
Another suggestion we had was The Bantaloons.
We have decided to unequivocally reject both of those suggestions.
Absolutely.
And we're still on the lookout for a name for this podcast that we can put on our CVs. Right, so today we've decided to talk about adaptation. We had some comments from listeners of the first podcast that they'd be interested to hear about our choices and our processes when we're adapting classic texts. For the first 7 years of the Pantaloons' existence, we just did Shakespeare texts. We worked our way through a variety of Shakespeare texts. That was my specialism, so that was very much what the company was about in its early days. But then round about 2010, we decided to branch out. And I remember a key moment in rehearsals for Macbeth in 2010. Do you remember that, Mark, when we hit on the idea of doing,
yes,
for our following summer tour, the Canterbury Tales? And it's just everyone in the room suddenly realised, yes, we should absolutely do that. It really fits with what the company's becoming. Mark, could you run through the classic texts that we've adapted since 2010?
Well, Steve, you know I have a list, so I absolutely can. The texts we've tackled are A Christmas Carol, The Canterbury Tales, we've done Bleak House, Grim Fairy Tales, Gulliver's Travels, Jekyll and Hyde, Pride and Prejudice, Sherlock Holmes, The War of the Worlds, and Treasure Island.
And we're about to begin adapting our next big project, which is The Odyssey, which will be touring in the spring. But I thought we might start by just talking about how we choose which texts to adapt.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously that first time we decided to do a non-Shakespeare play, when we were discussing in 2010... for the following summer, we hit upon the idea of doing the Canterbury Tales. It very much felt like a continuation of the work we were doing. It's mostly verse based, like Shakespeare. It was it's an older text, and it felt like it was continuing with the tradition of what we'd already started doing. I think as time's gone on, we've moved further away from that, and the first one we actually ended up doing, although we decided on Canterbury Tales first, we ended up that year, 2010, doing a tour of Christmas Carol. And again, Dickens has a kind of similar appeal to Shakespeare in the tradition of popular literature. Mm. You can tease out very similar things from Dickens as you can from Shakespeare. There's larger-than-life characters mixed in with more naturalistic, I suppose, characters. So that one felt right as well, I think, within what we do. I remember, it's not an adaptation, but I remember feeling very awkward about first directing The Importance of Being Earnest, which we did in 2012. I think that's the first time I felt we were moving away from the kind of things that the Pantaloons did. And now that seems strange to me, but certainly the Canterbury Tales and A Christmas Carol felt like they were part of the same tradition.
Mm. I suppose there's something to be said about most of the classic texts we've adapted being very well-known texts, which of course is good for us in a very pragmatic sense because we get bookings for them, people know the titles, they want to see them, venues want to have them. But something that's perhaps rooted in the DNA of the company is subverting very famous tropes. So when we do Dickens, when we do Chaucer, when we do Jane Austen, there's an element whereby we can be semi-parodic. We can step outside of the thing that people think they know already and gently satirise it, yeah, just as we do with Shakespeare.
These texts lend themselves to it. Dickens is almost self-parodying at times. His texts very much lend themselves to that. And there's less of it, but it's still there in Jane Austen, as you say, and Shakespeare very much so, as we've discovered over the years. So yes, those texts lend themselves to that. What becomes trickier is when we started moving on to adapting texts which don't necessarily lend themselves to that in the same way. Things like The War of the Worlds. It's a world away from the work of Dickens in that sense.
So, yeah, all of those early texts that we adapted, the Dickens, the Austen, the Chaucer, they're all texts that are already funny, already full of very theatrical, larger-than-life characters. Just as we're doing with Shakespeare, we're kind of both mocking it from the outside and lovingly inhabiting it from the inside. And yeah. I suppose that's a different dynamic, isn't it, when we come to a text that isn't automatically funny, isn't automatically self-aware, self-referential. We talk in our mission statement, don't we, about having one foot in the world of the here and now and one foot in the world of the fiction. And there's something about those early texts that we adapted that lends itself to that. And then as we've moved on, perhaps we found a company style that allows us to do that with texts that don't automatically invite that.
I think that's absolutely it. And one of the things I'm quite aware of when I'm adapting texts that don't necessarily lend themselves to it is I try not to poke fun, to parody the text itself. I tend to try and make the jokes come from the staging of the play. So they're jokes about the theatricality of it or the impossibility of what we're trying to stage. So something like The War of the Worlds lends itself to humour based on how you're attempting to stage things that cannot be staged. Similar with Sherlock Holmes, when I adapted that, I tried to get the jokes to be about the play rather than the text.
Yeah, in fact, if you look over a lot of the adaptations we've done, a lot of them have been structured, haven't they, by the idea of us being hubristically overambitious. So Canterbury Tales, the idea was we were going to do all the Canterbury Tales in a 2-hour show. Bleak House, the idea was we were going to do every single chapter of this massive brick of a novel. War of the Worlds, of course, we've got all these special effects. Gulliver's Travels, again, this epic story. And you're doing it with a cast of four with a kind of deliberately shoestring budget.
Yeah, I think one of the lines that sums it up for me is in Sherlock Holmes. There was just a moment where Holmes and Watson are in a spot of bother and they need to hide. So Watson says, "Quickly, Holmes, off stage," and takes them off stage. And it's almost like the characters of Holmes and Watson have been transplanted into a world where they are aware they are in a play, but they are the characters themselves. So I've tried to be respectful to those characters, but put them in a situation, a Pantaloons show, where they are aware of their own theatricality.
Yeah, and that's an ingredient in pretty much every single adaptation we've done, isn't it?
Yeah.
On some level, they're aware they're telling a story, and sometimes that is the story, isn't it? The overarching structure of a lot of our adaptations is the story of someone trying to tell a story.
Yeah, I think it allows you to be respectful. It allows you to do funny things with the characters without undermining the characters.
It kind of enables you to step in and out of it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Some of the adaptations are co-written collaboratively amongst the cast in some cases, between the two of us in others, but mostly they've been written just by you. Should we talk about how we decide whether or not to write collaboratively or adapt solo?
The thing that occurs to me about that is that the ones that have been co-written have tended to be very episodic pieces. So The Canterbury Tales we wrote as a team, Grimm Fairy Tales again as a team, Steve and I are sharing writing duties on The Odyssey, because again that's a very episodic piece. All of these ones have episodes, and some of them have very different voices who are telling the stories, The Odyssey included. And obviously The Canterbury Tales has 26 different narrators, so obviously it's easier to give it out to different voices. But I think the original intention was that we would adapt Bleak House together, but when we started it was clear that Bleak House is your favourite novel, pretty
yeah,
much, isn't
yeah,
it, Steve?
Yeah.
So it was clear that Steve had the adaptation of Bleak House mostly in his head. He knew how the structure was going to work. I had seen adaptation on television. I hadn't read the book, and I was reading the book and sort of trying to get a handle on everything. It's a very complicated story. It's a very long book. And I think by the time I'd sort of got a little way into it, Steve had already sort of come up with the structure and knew how he was going to bring it down. So in the end, it kind of made sense for Steve to take ownership of the whole adaptation.
But equally, I suspect, had we started off planning, say, our adaptation of Pride and Prejudice or War of the Worlds as a collaboration, we may well have found something similar happening. Those sorts of texts somehow are more unified, more intricately structured, less episodic, and so you need, I suspect, that single vision, as it were, for how the whole thing fits together, which doesn't matter so much when we're adapting episodic narratives.
Mm. Things can feel like their own, different episodes can feel like their own thing, self-contained. Whereas when you're adapting a whole novel, it kind of has to feel like, you know, one piece at the end. And, you know, people chip in, and we'll talk a bit later about how the actors themselves add things to the adaptations in the rehearsal room.
Should we talk about the first steps in adaptation? So we've picked our text, we've decided who's going to adapt it. What happens then?
The initial panic, because I haven't read it normally. That's not true. although it's true for something like Pride and Prejudice, I hadn't read it. Which is, you know, can be quite a good way to the first time you read a book, for it to be with a view to adapt it. You look at it in maybe a different way. You're going through it and you're thinking, okay, I like this theme from the book, I'm going to emphasise that. I like these characters, I'm going to make sure I keep those and I don't lose much of their stuff. This subplot that I'm following now looks like it's developing in a way that means I can cut most of it out for time. I think, yeah, maybe the start, the first steps. For me, I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach it. For me, I think I try and work out a structure. So I work out which subplots can go, what's going to stay, how that's going to be, and I try and put together a decent plan of how it's going to become play-shaped. The other way to do it, and I know Steve's done a bit of this, and I'm currently doing this for Sense and Sensibility, which we're touring in summer 2019, is to map out the characters and their relationships, and then work out how those characters can be doubled up. Because one of the trickiest things about adapting for a small cast is that you've got four or five people playing 20 to 30 characters, and how those roles get divvied up between people that require the least amount of reworking of the whole text to mean those people can avoid meeting.
Yeah, I don't know if you do this, Mark, but I remember for Bleak House, I literally had a spreadsheet. And I filled in a little cross where characters have a scene together that I felt couldn't go. And then just kind of what was left over was the possible doubling. And then I ended up, I did a colour-coded chart where I had some ideas about who was going to play which role. There were five actors in Bleak House. And then I listed all of the major scenes that I wanted to include in the adaptation, with all the characters who were in them, and colour-coded each character. And then sooner or later you realise, okay, so I have two characters who are played by that actor in this scene, one of them has to go. And just very pragmatic decisions like that end up...
Well, I've got a sprawling spider diagram of Sense and Sensibility character relationships. And you can sort of see from that, it's a very visual way of doing it, I can see, you know, some characters end up far, far away, with no arrows going to them from another character. Well, this is going to be a doubling possibility. Well, the first thing is to identify, when you've got four or five people, which their main characters are going to be. It generally works out that not many stories have more than four or five key main characters who have the majority of the stage time once it becomes a play. So once you've worked out what those are, you then sort of can stack the doubling, the characters on top.
I wanted to pick up on something you said there, Mark, which was working out how to make the text play-shaped. Mm. And I really like that, because a play is a different shape, isn't it, than a novel or an epic poem or a collection of stories. I mean, one thing for me is a kind of distillation of the skeleton plot that might underlie... So I remember with Bleak House, we're doing this with The Odyssey right now as well, there are so many aspects to the story. It's so long. There are so many different directions in which it goes. But in a play, you tend to want to tell just one story. Mm. And I remember with Bleak House thinking, okay, so I'm telling the story of... It was three in this case. I'm telling Richard's story, I'm telling Esther's story, and I'm telling Lady Dedlock's story. And I plotted out what those three stories are and how they intertwine. And then everything else, I just cut. Everything else went by the wayside. So whole characters, whole subplots. I cut out Harold Skimpole entirely from our adaptation, just because he didn't really factor in a way that I couldn't afford to lose into any of those three main plots.
Yeah, I think with Pride and Prejudice, for example, obviously the thing that people are coming to see it for is Lizzie and Darcy and their relationship. And that obviously had to form the main focus of that play. that they've got the, you know, that's the main arc of Pride and Prejudice is their romance and dislike for each other. So for that play, I tried to make sure I kept as much of that as possible, and just about every other character in there, even characters who normally play quite straight, like Jane, become slightly more clownish supporting characters to this main thread of the Lizzie Darcy story. And I tried to keep them feeling fairly naturalistic, and everything else is more playful around them. So it's about that. It's about having that main story strand. And
you did something brilliant, I thought, with War of the Worlds, where you distilled what's quite a sort of sprawling, almost journalistic style novel into a very human story.
Yes, you've got to take a theme. The one I went on was hope. The hope that he would, that the main character would get back to, the unnamed narrator would get back to his home and his wife at the end of the this horrific journey that he goes on. So everything else, as you get all those journalistic details, I try to keep some of the details. It's a lot of descriptive. Obviously, the conceit of the book as H.G. Wells wrote it was that this character would be making a note of as much as possible so he could pass on all this information about how these Martians were, how they behaved, how the machines worked. And I tried to keep a lot of those details in because that's faithful to the book. But you need something to drive a play, so it had to become much more about him getting home and back to his wife. And it becomes a play about missing the person you love, rather than a play about aliens.
And of course, some of the adaptations we've done, like Grimm Fairy Tales and Canterbury Tales, are collections of stories. So we've had to find other ways of making those play-shaped, haven't we?
We introduced the conceit in the Canterbury Tales that the squire, the youngest person on the pilgrimage, is terrible at telling stories. So as well as the conceit being in the original Canterbury Tales that they all go to tell a tale on their way to Canterbury and one on the way back. Or is it supposed to be two tales on the way to Canterbury and two on the way back? He sets himself an impossible task.
Chaucer sets up a much bigger task than he ends up writing.
He just ran out of time, and also was forced to atone for what he wrote, also judging by his
Just died as well. I mean, I think he died before he finished.
Didn't he write an apology for a retraction? That's it. He wrote a retraction of things that he wrote in his life that tended towards sin. I think is the phrasing goes.
So we included the retraction in the show, didn't we? Chaucer just appears for a moment.
So he sets up this, it is a storytelling competition. And who, you know, whoever wins is going to get a free meal when they get back from Canterbury, which is a pretty rubbish prize, really. It wasn't quite enough for a play, particularly as Chaucer didn't finish writing all the tales. The competition itself wasn't enough of a driving factor, so we also introduced the squire learning how to tell a tale to some degree and having multiple attempts, until at the end he improvises a tale and is declared the winner against the odds. We create an underdog, basically. And also, we added the conceit of the idea of having to finish all the tales that Chaucer wrote within 2 hours and before they get to Canterbury in the fiction of the play. But we introduced the time constraint and this idea of the squire being the underdog trying to come through to give that one a overarching thing beyond just there's some people together and they're telling tales. It needs something like that to drive it through.
We did something similar with Grimm, didn't we, where it was the three Grimm brothers and the two, we called them the Wild Sisters or the Wild Sisters, who were actual sisters in the Grimm social circle who told them some of the stories that ended up in their collection. I say three Grimm brothers because there was a third Grimm brother who didn't contribute to the collection, and we made a story of him as well. And then I seem to remember that the climax for that one was that they'd all fallen out as they were telling tales slightly competitively, and then all came together at the end to reconcile through storytelling.
Yes, yeah. Ferdinand was unable to tell a tale, I seem to think, and in everyone else trying to tell him what a good story was, they all realised that they disagreed on what a good story actually was. And in the end, Ferdinand brings them back together by telling a tale at the climax of a show.
Perhaps we should talk about some of the changes that happen during rehearsal. So we've written the text, we've sent it around to the actors. The actors have learned it, mostly.
by the first night.
Exactly. We show up at the first day of rehearsal, what happens then? How does rehearsal change or condition the adaptation?
Well, obviously structure doesn't change. Once it's written, that's sort of set in stone. But when I tend to adapt, I put in some jokes here and there where they occur to me as I write them. But a lot of the jokes you will see in a pantaloon show have been added by the cast or director when we're actually in the room. And they occur to us. And a lot of them are verbal gags. You know, there's a lot of physical comedy that gets added that's not in the script. That's one way it changes quite a lot. But also, there's two strands of ad-libs. There's ones get ad-libs that people make in rehearsal that get added then to the text and become part of it. And then when it goes out on the road again, ad-libs that come off the back of things happening around the show and the actors responding in the moment to those.
And we sometimes structure in opportunities for that as well, don't we?
Yeah, we write in sections of the show. So there were sections in Gulliver's Travels where there were little set pieces where Gulliver's attacked, a tiny Gulliver is attacked by giant wasps in Brobdingnag, the land of the giants. And I pretty much just put a short description. He gets attacked by wasps. Something funny happens. And then we work those into rehearsal. And sometimes that dialogue is added. A lot of time music is added to those sections. But yeah, there's some things that are kind of half written and developed in rehearsal.
And of course, we're continuing to edit, aren't we? One of the things that often happens in rehearsal is we discover that there's a particular section of the play that's dragging that we weren't expecting to, or we discover that for some reason the tone of a particular moment isn't working, so we change it. I remember I really enjoy co-directing with Mark because we don't often co-direct, but we have done occasionally. And
yeah.
And the two of us have slightly different instincts, both as adapters and as directors. And my instinct is always to go for story, to clarify story. And Mark has a much more kind of anarchic instinct towards finding moments of humour. And actually, these two instincts, I think, can kind of dovetail really neatly sometimes. Yeah. Where you'll go, no, Steve, we don't need this, cut this out, replace it with something funny. And sometimes equally I'll be there saying that's very funny, but what's it doing in the play? And that kind of collaborative approach can help us to come up with something that is both funny and well paced and clear.
Absolutely, yeah. Things can change quite a lot in rehearsal. The version of Christmas Carol that we've got on the road at the moment, the conceit is that it's performed by the Pantaloons Penny Circus, a Victorian travelling circus group who are a bit ramshackle, and they are telling the story of Christmas Carol. And the first act of Christmas Carol ends with the Ghost of Christmas Past, and it's a very depressing scene where Scrooge sees the love of his life, Belle, has gotten married and has children with another man, and they're discussing how sad and lonely Ebenezer Scrooge is. And it's a very sad moment, but it comes halfway through, so that's where the interval falls. So the Penny Circus decide that they need something to lift the mood at that moment and to perform something else. And I think in the original script and what we did last time was that they put on a kind of pseudo freak show without any freaks. It was just a series of weak gags to try and lighten the mood, to literally try and lighten the mood before an interval, because sometimes you want to leave people sort of buoyant by the time the interval happens. So this time, in rehearsal, we came up with the idea of inserting something that is kind of reworked from our history of Britain, which was it became a thing in Christmas Carol called Queen Victoria's Christmas Cabaret, which is a music hall act led by one of the Penny Circus performers becoming Queen Victoria, and the others becoming the engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel and the scientist Charles Darwin, and they come out and sing music hall songs and tell Christmassy gags to try and raise the spirits. But it's just one of those things that comes out of rehearsal. We need something to happen here. Wasn't happy with what we had. Let's put something else in. I'll write some new material and we'll use that.
There was a brilliant bit I remember that you added to Bleak House one of the days that I wasn't in rehearsal.
Sorry.
No, it was brilliant. It was a really, really good gag. It was a moment in the narrative where things had got very, very serious. It was all nearing the climax. And we realised we'd lost the the funny through line that was very, very present in the first half, and we needed something, a comic through line through the, it was sort of the beginning of the second half, wasn't it? And so Mark just came up with this gag where Dickens characters would, from other novels, would enter and be told by Inspector Bucket, who's the authoritative character on stage at that point, that they're in the wrong place and they need to get out.
Okay, yeah, then Ebenezer Scrooge pop up. You, what day is this? sorry, wrong play. Oliver Twist asking for more.
Yeah, and then David Copperfield
coming on and doing some of his magic tricks that David Copperfield is famous for. I don't see what's wrong with that.
It was a great gag.
But I think that's the thing. I think with adding these things, not to undermine anything. Again, they're extra textual things. And the idea is we're playing a joke. Again, those jokes are not poking fun at Bleak House. At Dickens' wider works, perhaps. But they're sort of taking place outside of the play.
And although then, I always got the impression it was slightly poking fun at Bleak House, because Bleak House has so many characters. Why not add a few
more? Yeah, everyone else feels left out because they're not a character in Bleak House. I mean, that's part of it, I suppose. But the point was, as you say, it had gotten quite serious, and we didn't want to. It's not to turn the show back into a comedy. It's to keep that mix of comedy and tragedy, and keep walking that line that I think our best work treads so well, that line between comedy and tragedy.
Yeah, we find it doesn't undermine, does it? Comedy doesn't undermine tragedy. It actually somehow paradoxically helps it.
Adds. And I feel this when we do Romeo and Juliet. And Romeo and Juliet starts off pretty much as a comedy. It's really funny at the start. You've got this Mercutio guy going around making loads of gags. And then it all goes wrong by the end. And I think if you don't emphasise the comedy there, it's, you can't make it as sad as it can be. I always think it's much sadder if characters die that you found appealing. It's too tempting, I think, to make Romeo and Juliet like representative of a sort of idealised romance. If you make them funny and you make them likeable at the start, instead of trying to make them something Cupid-like, you can actually get much more tragedy out when they're gone. If you miss the characters and you miss the comedy that was there earlier in the play, you can make things much sadder. And I think that's what we try and do with our own adaptations as well, is to add the comedy to emphasise the tragedy.
Yeah, because you notice the silence more in productions like War of the Worlds, Bleak House, even actually Canterbury Tales. Canterbury Tales is really funny mostly, but there are particular tales in Canterbury Tales that suddenly take the mood right down and become very serious. And I always feel that when the audience has been very vocal, laughing, joining in, those moments then when everyone collectively falls silent, it feels like a shared silence in a way that it might not otherwise. Perhaps we should talk about the way in which our adaptations change after rehearsal as well. So both on tour and in some cases, Treasure Island, Christmas Carol, Canterbury Tales and others, for subsequent tours after we've done the show once, how we change it when we come back for a second or third time.
Once the actors take a show on the road, I like to think of it as the show no longer belongs to me as a writer or me as a director. I don't know how you feel about it, Steve, but I feel like now it belongs to the actors. I hope we've instilled in them during rehearsal the kind of rules that mean they won't take it in a direction that we feel does undermine it, but we feel that they own it, and it's kind of theirs to reshape in small ways. So no one's going to go and gut half the play after it's on the road. But once it's in front of an audience, it's only then that you know how people actually respond to it. So some jokes that we find hilarious when we've been in rehearsal, we've layered sometimes a joke on top of a joke on top of a joke, we find it falls a bit flat, and actually we end up sometimes losing things that we found hilarious in rehearsal once we're on the road, just for time. And then sometimes jokes that we didn't realise people were going to find funny, people are falling about, and then you can take this play in a direction where you try and emphasise that and try and go for more laughs in that direction. There are certain times where something will happen in a performance, there are those, particularly in the open air when it starts to rain or a dog runs across the stage, where you get to reference something that's happening in the moment and you can get a huge laugh on that. And then sometimes these things can work their way into the fabric of the play too. where a response to something that's happened live has got a particularly good reaction, you can try and work out how that character can use that every time that the play is performed from then.
We've sometimes completely restructured shows as well, haven't we? Canterbury Tales, when we restaged it.
I think we're restaging, yeah. When we had to talk about restaging, things have changed a lot. So Canterbury Tales originally had a kind of, we'll call it a cascade of tales towards the end where things got faster and faster. And I think when we revisited it, we decided that we'd scatter some of the shorter tales throughout the play a bit more, because otherwise it had this kind of feeling towards the start where there's a series of very long tales and the audience don't know they're going to get faster to the towards the end. So you're kind of setting up this thing where the audience think the show could go on for about 5 hours until you get to the end and go, oh, we're going to go really fast now. But actually we decided later to put some of those, it worked better to put some of the shorter tales earlier. So you're saying, hey, look, some of them are going to be a limerick. We're going to get this play is going to, and also then it's got a more interesting kind of pacing. One of the ones that's changed quite a lot is the Christmas Carol, first book I adapted for stage, and one that's currently on the road. That one's changed quite a lot. In 2010, I was quite anti the idea of having any of the action narrated. I wanted to not have narrators. I wanted everything to be told in action. So I was writing new lines to replace lines of dialogue, lines of narration from Dickens. And I had the cast being carolers, carol singers, who then were telling the tale of Christmas Carol without narration. The most recent adaptation has fully embraced the characters occasionally narrate sections of it, which means you get to keep more of, and this is where I've come round on narration, when you're adapting a classic text, if you keep some narration, you get to keep more of the book as it was written by the author. And I think a lot of adaptations lose an awful lot of the character of... I've seen some really dry TV and film adaptations of Dickens.
And Jane Austen too, I think, yeah.
Where you lose a lot of the humour, because a lot of the humour is actually in the narration. And if you do not have a narrator or reallocate those narration lines, you lose so much humour. I think the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice did a very good job of keeping the humour.
Mm. One of the things I've really enjoyed about your adaptations of both Dickens and Austen is the way in which that narration aids in the game of putting on the show itself. You feel like these characters who are telling you the story are enjoying telling the story so much that that becomes a story in itself. That becomes the joy of the show, is these slightly gossipy characters in your adaptation of Pride and Prejudice who really want to satirise each other the way they narrate what's going on, or Christmas Carol, the way we get some of those very theatrical descriptions of what's going on. But in fact, both of our Dickens adaptations, Your Christmas Carol, My Bleak House, had a Dickens-like figure, haven't they?
Your Bleak House has Dickens
turn
up. So Your Bleak House had multiple narrators. I think your adaptation is where my turning point happened for me, and including narration in adaptation, is it creates it's got Dickens and it's got Esther's voice, who does some first person narrative in her chapters, and also at times all the other actors were able to narrate as necessary when they weren't playing another character. They could come in and add a bit of the narration, which is a very useful device. But it also creates this thing that, yeah, the multiple voices, and that, yeah, as I say, emphasising that feeling that the show is a game, and that the cast are playing a game of putting on the show. For a faithful adaptation of Bleak House, I think you need to have that Dickens narrator and that Esther narrator, because that's how the book is. It almost alternates, doesn't it, in chapters between those two voices. And I think if you lost the narration entirely, you'd lose a lot of the feel of the book.
So perhaps we should finish by just thinking about the future. We've got adaptations of The Odyssey and Sense and Sensibility on the horizon.
Mm.
We'd be really interested to hear what you, the listener, think we should do next, preferably something in the public domain. By the way, we do try to do stuff that's not in the public domain, that's still in copyright every so often, but almost invariably either it's prohibitively expensive or just someone else has the stage right.
But we do look from time to time. Hopefully there'll come a point where we do manage to nab the rights to something we particularly want to adapt. But we'd be, yeah, very interested in hearing your suggestions, whether in or out of the public domain. We'd certainly be very interested to hear.
And we'll leave that there. So We very much hope you enjoyed this second episode of the Pantaloons podcast, and tune in again, and send in your suggestions for what you'd like us to discuss next.
Bye-bye.